All right. Diana?
So we can directly move to agenda paper 14A, which is the first paper for the IBO meeting. This agenda paper discusses the overarching principles underlying the phase one end of application requirements and the interaction of phase two proposed amendments with the end of application requirements for the highly probable requirement, the prospective assessments, and the IES 39 retrospective assessments. I will tee up these areas separately and will pause after each section for comments or questions from board members, but we will ask questions on them together at the end. As noted in paragraph 9, our analysis on application of the separately identifiable criteria in context of the phase two tentative decisions will be discussed at the next board meeting. Moving on to the general end of application requirements for phase one, which are discussed in paragraphs 10 to 17 of the paper. In paragraph 10 of the paper, we highlight that the phase one exceptions cease to apply when uncertainty arising from the reform is no longer present with respect to the hedge risk and IBOR-based cash flows of the designated financial instruments, or when the hedging relationship is discontinued, if that is earlier. Not all phase one exceptions apply at the level of the hedging relationship, but are applied separately to different elements of the hedging relationship. As noted in the paper, the uncertainty about the timing and amount of interest rate benchmark-based cash flows could be eliminated in various ways, although modifications are expected to be the most common. These modifications could be either those that are required by the reform and are done on an economically equivalent basis, or it could involve other modifications that don't qualify for the practical expedient. However, as the board's tentative decisions to date focused on modifications that are a direct consequence of the reform and are done on an economically equivalent basis, the analysis in this paper focuses on interactions with those modifications only. In paragraphs 18 to 23, we discuss the highly probable requirement, which applies to the hedged item only. In paragraphs 19 and 20, we note that after applying the phase two proposed amendments for modifications done on an economically equivalent basis, the IFR-based cash flows will be the hedged cash flows to which the highly probable requirement will be applied. Therefore, as long as the hedging relationship continues to satisfy the qualifying criteria for hedge accounting, the amounts accumulated in the cash flow hedge reserve will be reclassified to profit or loss in the same periods during which the hedged IFR-based cash flows affect profit or loss. In our view, this will apply similarly to discontinued hedging relationships in which the previously designated hedged item is modified to replace the interest rate benchmark with an alternative benchmark rate. With that, I can pause here if anyone has any questions or comments. Okay, so we can move on to discuss. Okay.
Sorry. Omer, I just wanted to check the implication of something. If you look back at paragraph 16, which you just covered, I'm checking that the way I'm looking at the sentence that says, you know, tentatively decided to include an exemption. Therefore, when the hedged item or hedging instruments have been modified and the relevant changes to the hedging relationship and hedge documentation have been made, for the relief that applies to at the individual instrument level, the updating of the hedged hedging relationship and hedge documentation is not a mechanism for extending the period of the phase one relief. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, because it came across as just kind of a statement that you can keep the phase one running until you elect to update the hedge documentation. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Mine's also just a wording thing as well, and you actually addressed it in your tee-up, but I just wanted to sort of say it out loud again to reinforce it. So in paragraph 15, you talk about the fact that if there's a modification which is as described in paragraph 14, which is one where the practical expedient would apply, that the uncertainty would be resolved. And you rightly said in your tee-up that that wouldn't be the only case. Basically, whenever you've changed the contract to put in the new rate, then that is the removal of the uncertainty. I think we're just going to have to be super, super careful when we go out with the basis or whatever, where we explain what we mean, because I've been shocked by the granularity of analysis people are putting on the staff papers in this project is above anything I've ever seen. And so I don't want people to read something into this that we don't mean. So,
And I think we tried to make that clear in paragraph 12, where we said that, you know, contractual amendments, so we're not talking about just modifications,
yep,
you know, in any shape or form. We're saying that contractual amendments, although they are expected to be the most common way, they are neither required or the only way in which the uncertainty can.
I know what you mean. I'm just worried somebody will read the words in paragraph 15, which says, in other words, when it's modified in accordance with 14, they might overread, which isn't what you mean. So.
Okay.
We can move on to the next section then. Paragraphs 24 to 29 of the paper discuss the phase one end of application requirement for prospective assessments and its interaction with the phase two proposed amendments. This exception applies on an individual item by item basis. In other words, as the uncertainty for an individual instrument is eliminated, the entity ceases to assume that the interest rate benchmark is not altered for that instrument. As noted in paragraph 27 of the paper, a timing mismatch may arise between when the phase one exception ceases to apply to the hedging instrument and to the hedged item. This could affect the prospective assessment of effectiveness due to the resulting basis risk. Although in some situations this could result in the hedging relationship no longer being expected to meet the prospective effectiveness requirements, as we note in paragraph 28, the phase two proposed amendments permit redefining the hedge risk, and this would support entities in minimizing hedge ineffectiveness, provided the hedging relationship continues to satisfy the qualifying criteria for hedge accounting. With that, I can pause here to see if there are any questions or comments on this section. So we can move to the final section of the paper, which discusses the IES 39 retrospective assessment. This is discussed in paragraphs 30 to 35 of the paper. This exception applies until there is no uncertainty arising from IBOR reform in the hedging relationship. In paragraph 32, we note that when this exception ceases to be applied, the actual results of the hedge might be outside the 80 to 125% range, and this would require discontinuation of hedge accounting prospectively. In staff's view, such an outcome would be inconsistent with the board's objective for phase one exceptions to not discontinue hedge accounting solely due to uncertainties arising from IBOR reform. The phase two amendments proposed for IES 39 require an entity to make changes to the hedging relationships that are needed to reflect modifications that are made to the hedged items and hedging instruments. Such changes could include changing the method used to assess hedge effectiveness. When an entity assesses effectiveness based on the cumulative changes in fair value, a situation could arise where the ineffectiveness recognized during the period, the actual results breach the 80 to 125% threshold when the phase one exception ceases to apply. The staff therefore recommend a further exception to be made, as noted in paragraph 34, to require entities only for the purposes of retrospective assessment to reset the cumulative fair value changes to zero at the date the phase one exception ceases to apply. The staff highlight that this does not change the requirements to measure the hedged item and hedged risk as required by IFRS standards or to recognize any ineffectiveness in P&L. This brings us to the questions that we have for the board that are after paragraph 35. I can pause here to see if there are any questions or comments.
Sue.
I agree with your recommendations. Just one clarification. We've got the word allow in question 1A, but you use the word require when you present it. We mean require?
We
don't get to choose whether you want to exclude it or not.
Well, I think we intend to mean require, but we'll have that paper next month to talk about which.
Because I wouldn't vote for allow.
I think that's. We sort of preempted where we will be next month by saying, you know, it should really be require.
Well, what will update, so, if we vote for it?
Require.
We'll put an addendum in our standards for allow, read, require. Jen Chow.
I agree with staff's proposal, just the one word in clarification. About the question 1A, here we say that the cumulative value resets to zero. I think actually it's the accumulation. Accumulative value changes resets to zero.
Yes.
Could could use a neutral word in update, provide that, because I think that's what you mean.
Yeah.
Write down is what you're trying to say. Yeah.
Okay, any other comments? Are we ready to vote for question one?
So, question one A is whether the board agrees with the staff recommendation in paragraph 35 that IS 39 be amended to require that for the purposes of assessing retrospective effectiveness only, the cumulative fair value changes reset to zero at the date the exception to the retrospective assessment ceases to apply.
Can I just check? So we have now moved to require, as opposed to provide.
14.
In question 1B, asks the board whether it agrees with the staff recommendations that no amendments should be made to the phase one end of application requirements for the highly probable requirement or the prospective assessments.
Okay.
14.
With that, we can move to agenda paper 14B. Hand over to Chris.
Agenda paper 14B focuses on the potential effects of the interest rate benchmark reform on IFRS standards other than those related to financial instrument accounting. There are five topics discussed in this paper, and in two of them, the staff recommend amendments to IFRS standards. For the other three topics, the staff analysis suggests that in the context of the IBOR reform, current requirements in IFRS standards provide sufficient guidance to determine the appropriate accounting treatment. Each topic is followed with a question to the board. Hence, if the board members agree, I will tee up them separately and pause after each question for the board to discuss. The first topic relates to the accounting for lease modifications directly required by the IBOR reform from the perspective of the lessee and the lessor. Paragraphs 10 to 20 of the paper set out the analysis for lease modifications directly required by the reform from the perspective of the lessee. Without any amendment to IFRS 16, the replacement of IBOR with an alternative benchmark rate to a lease contract done on an economically equivalent basis would require it to be accounted for as a modification resulting in the reassessment of the lessee's entire incremental borrowing rate. The staff believed that this would not necessarily reflect the economics of the amended lease, thereby not providing useful information to users, and it might impose additional costs on preparers, particularly when IBOR reference leases are expected to be amended at different times. Therefore, the staff is recommending IFRS 16 to be amended to include a practical expedient so that the effects of the IBOR reform would be accounted for in the same way as any other changes in lease payments that result from a change in floating interest rates. If, however, any other modifications are made to the lease at the same time, the practical expedient should not apply and the entities should continue to apply the modification guidance in IFRS 16. Accordingly, paragraphs 21 to 25 set out the analysis for lease modifications directly required by the IBOR reform from the perspective of the lessor. For modifications to finance lease receivables, the staff expect that entities would apply the requirements to IFRS 9, including the amendments in the practical expedient discussed in the October 2019 board meeting. Given the mechanics of the operating lease accounting model, the staff do not consider it appropriate to apply a different approach for modifications to operating leases directly required by the reform. The staff is therefore not recommending any amendments to lessor accounting in IFRS 16. With that, I will turn your attention to question one on page 10 and ask the board whether you agree with the staff recommendation.
Sue.
I do agree with the staff recommendation. I just wanted to clarify one thing just to confirm. So the idea here is that the sort of same concept that we're planning to put into IFRS 9 about when you've sort of got economic equivalence and required modifications arising from the reform would be the boundary that we'd use to put into 16 as well. So we'd be using that same logic. But we're not going to be putting in the sort of two-step approach that we have in IFRS 9 where you look at the sort of modifications that are part of what's required and then a sort of second test of what is not.
Yes, we're not... we're not recommending including that two steps, because in IFRS 16, if you've got any other modifications, you in any case update the incremental borrowing rate to reflect the current conditions, and so that two steps won't
make sense.
It's an unnecessary step then. And so we've only focused on the actual practical experience, which says, well, you know, you update the rate as a change in the benchmark.
I agree with that.
Given the discussion we had 2 minutes ago, how should we read provide here in the recommendation?
The same.
So meaning that
what?
It's required.
Yeah.
Effort. Thank you. Okay, are we ready to vote? Question one.
14.
Next topic relates to the accounting for modifications of insurance contracts under IFRS 17, and specifically for cases where premiums received from policyholders or payments made to policyholders under interest rate guarantees are linked to the IBOR rate. The staff analysis is presented in paragraphs 34 to 39 of the paper. The staff observed that modifications being made to insurance contracts directly required by the reform and done on an economically equivalent basis would not trigger a derecognition event, because such modifications would not result in the extinguishment of the insurance obligation and would not lead to a different accounting outcome for the insurance contract under IFRS 17 if such modifications were present at contract inception. As a result of this analysis, paragraph 40 sets out the staff recommendation for no amendments to be made to IFRS 17. Therefore, entities should treat changes in cash flows caused by such modifications and as changes in estimates of fulfillment cash flows. Question two, on page 14 of the paper, asks the board whether you agree with this recommendation.
We do.
13, one absent.
14.
13, one absent.
Oh, okay.
Nice look with the glasses.
I thought it was you coming in late. Go on, Christos.
The third topic relates to IFRS 13, fair value measurement, and specifically whether any amendments to IFRS 13 are needed as a result of IBOR reform and the uncertainties arising from the process of replacing the IBOR rates with an alternative benchmark rates potentially affect the observability of inputs used to measure the fair value of financial assets or financial liabilities as IBOR become less liquid and volumes are decreasing. The staff analysis is set out in paragraphs 46 to 48 of the paper. The staff would highlight that transfers within the fair value hierarchy reflect both the economic reality of the observability of the benchmark rates as a result of the IBOR reform and the changes in the market structure. Therefore, we believe that it would provide useful information to the users of financial statements. As set out in paragraph 49, the staff did not recommend any amendments to the fair value hierarchy requirements in IFRS 13. I will now turn your attention to question three on page 17, asking the board whether you agree with the staff recommendation.
Nick.
So I do agree with the staff recommendation. I think it's clearly important that if there has been a change in the liquidity of the financial instrument and that reflects the economics of that instrument, that that's reflected in the fair value hierarchy. You mentioned there may be consequences in terms of regulatory capital. I think that's an issue for regulatory bodies, which they may or may not choose to adjust for, but that's their decision, not our decision.
Anne?
I also agree. I just wanted to ask about the disclosure between the levels. Will that get picked up through 13, or will that come in our disclosures in relation to IBOR reform?
That would be covered by the existing disclosures in IFRS 13.
Thank you.
Jungwoo.
Thank you. I agree with the staff recommendation. Just a clarification. So is the kind of possible increase in level 3 classification is temporary, right?
Well, it's temporary in the sense that those instruments might be modified so that they refer to another rate, and then, you know, they could move up. But, I mean, in terms of IBOR rates itself, the rates won't become more observable, I guess.
Okay, are we ready to vote?
14.
Another topic discussed in this paper relates to the indirect impact of IBOR reform on discount rates, which are used for measurement purposes from several IFRS standards. The staff analysis is included in paragraphs 54 and 55 of the paper. The staff is of the view that changes in discount rates as an indirect result of IBOR reform should be treated as changes in accounting estimates and recognized prospectively. Therefore, the staff recommendation set out in paragraph 56 of the paper states that the current IFRS standards already provide an adequate guidance to account for changes in discount rates. This brings us to question 4 for the board, as set out in paragraph 19, asking the board whether you agree with the staff recommendation.
We do.
13.
So then the last section of paper 14B. When IFRS 9 was finalized in 2014, the board agreed to provide a temporary exemption from applying IFRS 9 to insurance entities that meet certain criteria. And so IFRS 4 and IFRS 9 then, they can continue to apply IAS 39 in that case. And the board was also very clear at the time that IAS 39 will not be maintained other than the hedge accounting paragraphs. And since then, we haven't made any amendments or consequential amendments to IAS 39 for any new standards that's been amended, or even for changes that's been made to IFRS 9, as the board has confirmed again in November last year when finalising the annual improvements, which made an amendment to IFRS 9. So the staff has taken that into consideration, but we've also considered the impact that it would have if those insurance entities are not able to apply the same exceptions and practical experience for modifications to financial instruments that the board tentatively agreed to in November or October last year. And we considered that as those entities would also be required to make modifications to their financial assets, that you know they could also end up in a situation where they've got all of these assessments to do for all of the reasons that we've discussed in October and that the board decided and agreed to give the practical experience for financial instruments. And so acknowledging that this would be an exception to the board's current position, the staff is recommending to include, to make an amendment to IFRS 4 that would allow them to apply the practical expedience in IFRS 9 when they account for their modifications. So we're not, that's the only amendment we would recommend. We're not recommending updating IAS 39 because the standard doesn't exist anymore, those paragraphs. But at least if we put something in IFRS 4, then you know we can give them the relief while not upsetting the previous decisions.
Carol? So obviously this is going to be a very difficult decision to give effect to because we're adjusting something that doesn't actually now exist in our own literature. So I just to understand the way that you would give effect to this, so we would essentially, within IFRS 4, cross-reference the paragraphs in IFRS 9 that we've amended and say that those paragraphs are applicable for those who are still applying 39. Is that sort of the way it would work? Given that 39, as it stands at the moment, doesn't have exactly the same paragraphs, or would we try to actually pull in the 39 paragraphs and say this is the amendment to think about, or is that something you're still considering?
I think that's
something we're still considering.
Okay. I mean, I think it does highlight the complexities that we introduced by the decision we took when we took it.
Do you support it? I was hoping somebody kinder than me would speak first. So, do you support the amendment?
I think it is a unfortunate implication of a decision that we previously took. I do support this. I think we probably have to do it because of the repercussions of not doing it.
But as I say, it perhaps highlights for us going forward in terms of thinking about this sort of circumstance in the future. So what I'm probably doing is a mea culpa on this, saying that the previous decision is what ties us into this one.
Well, it's far beyond technical, so I wanted somebody other than me to be the first person to speak because, as you can imagine, I'm probably the most reticent to ever agree to looking after IS39 in its old form, given that there's a perfectly good new standard available in our book. And so I understand there's bigger issues at play here, and I can understand that for the insurance companies they've got exactly the same complications with having to deal with IBOR reform as everybody else, so I'm not without empathy. But having said that, I do worry a bit. Well, it shows the complexity of what we've decided to do. So we now, if you pick up our red book and our blue book, there is no IAS 39 classification and measurement requirements that exist. They're sort of a fictional thing, a ghost standard that exists that the insurance companies are using, and it's a handful of companies really in the scheme of things using the standard. And I think the challenge we've got from a drafting perspective, not insurmountable, but challenging for the staff, which is why I think we shouldn't be talking about how to draft it today, is that actually the modification requirements in 39 are not the same as in 9. So it's not as easy as saying sort of apply these paragraphs because they don't fit with the jigsaw that we've got in 39. So we're going to have to be quite crafty to work out a way to make it understandable and workable and clear enough. I'm sure we'll find a way, but it's non-trivial. And I think the thing that makes... So I think if we agree to do this, then so be it. You know, it's important to do the right thing for our stakeholders, but I think it needs to be a very strong signal from the board that we shouldn't have an expectation that every time we do something in 9, classification and measurement, we're going to start amending IAS 39 classification and measurement for a handful of companies. And I think the thing that worries me the most is that we've already allowed the insurance companies to use the bits of IFRS 9 they might like in the form of own credit. We're now going to give them the bits, I'm guessing, of the modification relief that they probably like, and we'll give them that in 39, and all the bits they don't like, ECL in particular, are sitting in 9, unused, and I'm just not sure about the incentives we're creating. So that's the end of my little spiel.
Tadeo?
Thank you, Hans. It's just to remember that we might have the same issue for SMEs. Some of them are allowed to apply IAS 39, especially when they are a subsidiary of company applying IFRS.
Sort of,
and I'm just wondering whether that it would also have a solution for those SME applying IAS 39.
That's a different version of 39 again. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's another version.
It was fixed at an earlier
fixed
date.
Fixed at a different date.
But one for insurance entities was fixed, but we are looking at that, so we are considering it. We're just not sure how we would do anything.
Just following up on Sue's and Daryl's remarks, really, two things. One is, I think it is also important that one of the messages that we are conveying by implication, but I'd like to make explicit, is that amendments that we make to IFRS 9 do not automatically, you know, either in terms of what we do or it should not be assumed to carry over to IAS 39. So basically, if we do not act in the way that the staff is recommending here, that these reliefs would not be available to those who are applying IAS 39. It's not like 39 somehow magically incorporates, you know, by osmosis changes that are made to IFRS 9 for those that are still applying it. And second, you know, I am reluctantly, you know, I will reluctantly agree with the staff recommendation, not because I'm criticizing the staff's thinking on it, but because I am concerned about the idea of continuing to invest in maintaining something for a very small population. I think in this instance, you know, something that Chris and Umair have referenced in the other issues is that we made decisions on the basis of assessing the usefulness of the information to users of financial statements of having discontinuance of hedge accounting relationships because of this IBOR reform, and drew the parameters in a way that responded to the information needs of users of financial statements. I think some of the other decisions that we make from time to time about amending a standard might, for example, be based more on cost-benefit or other factors which would not automatically be the same, you know, in respect of IS 39. So in terms of why it isn't, you know, a desire to be mean, I think it's just that we have to think very, very carefully about whether or not to go the extra step in terms of something for IS 39. I think in this case, considering the information needs of users, it's probably the lesser of two evils. But I don't think, you know, I don't want it to be perceived as, you know, setting a precedent for anything that happens automatically.
Anne? I want to ask whether we do have any choice here. So say we say, based on the conversation that we've had, say that we vote no on this and we say we're not going to for the reasons that have been outlined. Then I'm trying to speculate and imagine what the response is from this. So it may only be a few entities. I heard Sue say it's a small number of entities that are affected, but the entities belong to an industry. I imagine they'll be very loud about this, and why have they been singled out to be penalised through the accounting standards when everybody else, including leasing entities, got a practical expedient that they're able to apply? So I'm just trying to understand whether we actually have any choice here. I can appreciate what Sue and Daryl have said, and Mary, about the messiness of what we're doing and difficulty of actually doing it, but the whole messiness of IAS 39. And
I think that's exactly why the staff is recommending you do it, and it's also why Daryl and Mary are both supporting it.
So because we don't have an alternative.
Balance, it's good for the market.
Because it leaves uncertain future reporting, I think, for those in this industry. I think that's the issue.
Not just uncertainty. They would have a problem.
Well, they would have a problem.
Nick.
And that doesn't invest any bad.
So many users question the usefulness of these financial statements today, as we know. And I know that's a bigger question that we're trying to help resolve. I feel... personally, my flexibility is just about being pushed to the limit on this. I think I will, on balance, vote in favour of the staff recommendation, but really with a great deal of reluctance.
Françoise.
Well, let's have a little positive note in this discussion. I think what the staff is recommending is a very pragmatic approach to the situation we're facing. And I support that, and I acknowledge that it is difficult to do. So we're just, you know, giving you, proving that you face the difficulty. But I think it's the logical consequence of how IFRS stand today. And I don't see that we are bound in any manner by a decision that we make today with the decision that we will make tomorrow. We look at decisions in the whole context that they have, and so I think you made a perfect recommendation.
Jen Chow.
Thank you. I support the staff's proposal. I think if for those companies applying IFRS 9 can have this practical experience, and for those companies applying IS 39 have no this kind of practical experience, I think it's not fair for those companies, and they cannot provide comparable information for users. Another thing that how to do it. Yeah, I think it's a good thing that currently we're not to directly change the requirement of directly change the standards of IS 39. Actually, we are add some paragraph or add some change to IFRS 4. And we know that IFRS 4 is temporary standards address specific issues. So maybe I think it's understandable, and we have no solution. Alternative, I think, simply just to change IFRS 4 to provide practical experience for those companies applying IFRS 39. Yeah.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff's recommendation?
13.
What happened to question 5?
You've just voted on
question 5.
No.
There's a problem. I can ask one quick question then just on this paper in total. So I think in the analysis around the IFRS 17, IFRS 13, the analysis around the other general standards, those so questions 2, 3, and 4, there is quite a lot of useful material in the paper itself, and I just wondered whether you've given thought to how much of that would find its way into the basis or not, as the case may be.
We haven't thought about that yet.
Okay. It's in particular, I think, around the analysis for the discount rate on the other. I think that discussion is a useful discussion to see if it can find a way in some way.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Your paper.
Agenda paper 14C analyzes whether disclosures need to accompany the tentative decision that the board has made phase two of our report project. And if so, what disclosures would provide useful information to users of financial statements about the effect to an entity from transitioning from IBORs to alternative benchmark rates? In doing this analysis, the staff considered factors that are described in paragraph 10 of the paper, including talking to users and the Craft UK. The key messages heard from users are outlined in paragraph 14 of the paper, but in summary, users are supportive of the board's tentative decisions and the accounting outcome that for modifications directly required by IBOR reform, there will be no resulting gain or loss. However, they are interested for information where the entity provides information that will allow users to understand how an entity distinguished between modifications directly required by IBOR reform versus other modifications perhaps done concurrently. Users would also like to have information that would allow them to understand how an entity determined the economically equivalent rate. Secondly, they would like to understand the progress that the entity has made towards transitioning to alternative benchmark rates, as well as the nature and extent of risks that the entity is exposed as a result of IBOR reform, and how is the entity managing the transition. As a result of our analysis, the staff recommend that disclosures are needed to accompany the board's tentative decisions in phase two, and that the objective of those disclosures would be to provide information which allows users to understand, firstly, the nature and extent of risks arising from IBOR reform to which the entity is exposed to, and how the entity manages those risks, and secondly, the entity's progress in transitioning from IBORs to alternative benchmark rates, and how is the entity managing the transition. So the staff think that to achieve this objective, an entity would disclose information that is set out in paragraph 28 of the paper. With that, I'll turn your attention to questions in page 11 of the paper. Question 1. Do board members agree with the staff recommendation on the objective of disclosures as described in paragraph 27 of the paper?
Gary.
Thank you. As I read the recommendation in paragraph 28, it lines up pretty well with the user request in paragraph 14. And I'll speak for non-financial services career preparer. I think all these requests are reasonable. I could see a corporate treasury department, if IBOR reform was material to their capital strategy, that these would be the things they would care about. It would be tracking, again, perhaps not necessarily to the level of precision and auditability, but from a management governance point of view, I think this is what they would be doing. I think the recommendations are reasonable. Again, not speaking for being a money center banker or anybody who's a financial intermediary, but I think for general corporates, this is just fine.
Martin.
And I agree, but with one exception, which is 28D, and that this that entity should disclose the extent to which IBOR reform has resulted in changes to an entity's risk management strategy. I don't know what we want to achieve with that. Man, what should an entity say? I mean, it is more or less, I think it is hedging maybe interest rate risk. And should they say, I've stopped that? Or
And I think it is too far. And I think people will not maybe change the risk management strategy because of the IBOR reform, but to the transition, maybe they have some risk operationally how to doing that. And maybe we can, I think, include that what we, I think, want to achieve, what we have said in D as the second half of the sentence, into A and say, okay, the entity should disclose how it has managing the transition to the alternative benchmark rates and about the risks associated with this transition. I think that would be better disclosure than to focus on the bank's or the entity's risk management strategy, because I think it is not impacted by that. There's additional risk from the transition and they should disclose that. That would be my recommendation to change that.
Yes, I think it is. We can reword it so that we combine, you know, A and D in the sense that we capture still the risks that are arising out of the reform, because I think you're right. What is more important is the risks that are arising out of the transition, because I think the transition itself is a risk, this whole process. And so if we focus on that, plus how the entity is managing the process and its progress through that, then I think that still achieves the objective we are trying to set.
Mary?
Apologies, I'm going to put you on the spot with this question, and it really is actually prompted by some of the discussions we had yesterday in the disclosure initiative section. So paragraph 11C kind of maps to 28C. And an explanation of how the entity determined the base rate and the relevant adjustments to the rate to assess whether the modification to contractual cash flows were required as a direct consequence. Not, you know, I think we have the right criteria for what is, you know, what are the qualifying things, but how do we think a user of financial statements will use the information about how the entity has determined what the equivalent rate is? You know, what... You know, you're reporting in paragraph 11 that this is one of the things that people said they wanted to understand. And is that to force people to disclose enough so that people have confidence they did a robust job with determining what the equivalent rate is?
I think it is a bit of that, perhaps. But also, because as we've discussed in other meetings, at the same time, there's going to be other... It's likely that there's other changes being made to the contract and, you know, the credit spread might be revised or other changes might be added. And when we spoke to the users, they were just concerned that entities could use this opportunity to say that, well, you know, everything is sort of required by the reform and sort of hide things in that and not thereby showing what the actual economic impact is. And so I think their view was if they can understand how the entity came up with the economically equivalent rate, it would be easier to see when there are other changes to, you know, the interest income over time or whatever the case is, that they can then figure out what those kind of modifications were.
Nick?
I'm sympathetic to Martin's suggestion, but I think clearly we don't know if there'd be a change in the risk management strategy because of the reform as we stand today. I think if there were for a specific bank, that would be useful information. So I just wonder if we can somehow wrap that up in point A. So if there is a change in the risk management strategy, that is then communicated rather than addressing it quite as it's explained in point D, you know, where almost you have to give a negative assurance that there is no change.
I see Martin nodding.
And I think if it would be change in risk management strategy, I think that would be disclosed under 7 already. And
that's what I think too.
But I also agree, maybe we can mention that if there is.
Okay, with these comments, can we agree with the staff's recommendation?
14.
Okay. I think that's all the papers we've got for today. Maybe just to give you a sense of what's coming next. We are planning on, at the next meeting, to bring papers on the effective date, the transition, and, you know, just clarify that everything, what needs to be required or what is optional. So whether the relief is mandatory or voluntary, we'll have a paper on that. And we, as we've mentioned in paper 14A, we'll have a paper on the separately identifiable criteria. and just clarify what we, how we intend that to apply, given the phase two tentative decisions. And then, if all goes well, we'll also ask you for permission to start the balloting process at that meeting.
Okay. Thank you very much. We are well ahead of schedule. Nevertheless, I propose that we resume our meeting on the planned hour, 1:20, given the fact that many people are following our insurance. Reconvene at 1:20.